Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to A Change in Attitude, the podcast that drags you kicking and screaming 25 years into the past to see if the Attitude Era was all sunshine and roses like we imagine it is. I am Mags, and unfortunately today the rest of my team are unavailable, what with moving and technical difficulties. But I'm the lucky one, I suppose, because I get the opportunity to chat with the very first guest here on A Change in Attitude, somebody who's been a massive supporter of not only the podcast that I'm involved in, but so many other people's podcasts. He's become a shining light in our community here and in the RWC. He's been on quite a few podcasts before, and I'm glad that we're finally able to sit face to face and have a chat about it. So please, everybody, welcome the famous Kent's very own Scottish Danny. Danny, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Max. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Excited to finally get to chat with you. I mean, we talk so much over Twitter and over like the podcast that we both listen to and have been involved in, that this has been it feels like this has been so long, such a long time coming for you to be involved in a podcast with me.
No, I just want to say thank you to you, Ori, and Hannah for building this for someone like me to come on. This feels really good.
Yeah, it's not a problem. I mean, you've been, like I said, you've been doing the rounds on podcasts recently. What other podcasts have you appeared on before this?
Oh, I've appeared on quite a few now. I've appeared on Bang.
You're a veteran. You're a veteran in these streets.
I'm still at the jabroni level at the moment, though. But I've done the Bang Bang podcast and with Andy, as you've done yourself, and UTD. And I've also done a SJP podcast with Sai, which is brilliant. Yeah.
My chain wrestling tag team partner there. Every episode that you've been on of other people's shows, I've really enjoyed. And I really like your kind of your take on the wrestling scene. You're not someone who's particularly cynical about wrestling. You tend to find that in the wrestling community, that everyone it's fun to shit on stuff, but you take a more positive approach of it, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
So you've been drafted in for a very special episode. We're one of the big four pay-per-views. For context, we're recording this on the 21st of November, which is ironically the day of Survivor Series 2021. And we're actually going back 25 years to Survivor Series 1996, which was recorded or shown on the 17th of November. So essentially this week, 25 years ago, from Madison Square Garden in New York. Attendance was apparently a legitimate 19,000 or just shy, 18,647. If Aura was here, she'd give you the peacock number, but because we're in the UK, we still magically have the WWE Network app, although I do hear that Peacock is now in the UK, so the switch is probably coming very, very soon. But yeah, we're essentially at the mecca of wrestling, the Madison Square Garden. We have a cool opening package, which shows that WWE have been all over New York this week. And we start with the commentary team of Vince, Jerry Lawler, and Jim Ross. There was actually a match that was on the pre-show, which I think back then was called the free-for-all. The WWE Network doesn't seem to show that over here in the UK. I wonder if the Peacock one does. But we got a 4-on-4 Survivor Series match with Aldo Montoya, that wearing his jock strap, teamed up with Bart Gunn, Bob Holly, and the Road Dogg to take on Billy Gunn, Bradshaw, Salvatore Sincere, and the Sultan. The Faces winning in just over 10 minutes. But the opening match on this card is Doug Furness, Phil LaFon, making their debuts, and they're teaming with the Godwins, Henry and Phineas, to take on the Bulldog, Owen Hart, Leif Cassidy, and Marty Jannetty, the new Rockers. 20-minute match. Danny, let us know what you thought about this.
Well, the first thing I thought about this is how invasive was that alleyway when the fans could just grab anyone. It reminded me of the 2006 ECW crowd. Do you remember where the aisleway was and anyone could just grab a wrestler or grab, and you could see various, throughout the night of this night, you could see various wrestlers getting pissed off with it. But that's the first thing I caught my eye first. But in terms of the match, I would say, how bad was that Hillbilly Jim dub or network dub? That's the first thing.
It's a massive, massive issue. We mentioned it by the time this drops a couple of weeks ago on Chain Wrestling. It's one of the worst things about the network, how they've redubbed a lot of the music. It really, really pisses me off.
Yep, definitely. But and I also thought, how much of a waste was British Bulldog and Owen Hart in this match? They just felt totally out of place. I mean, the majority of these wrestlers were jabronis.
I mean, Phil LaFon and Furness were actually really legitimate in Japan. I think they've been drafted in because the tag scene in the WWF at the time was so heel heavy, and having Brett and Owen as Bulldog and Owen as heel champions, there was not a lot of really kind of legitimate face tag teams they could go against who they hadn't already faced over and over again. So they were drafted in to essentially provide a bit of competition. But this match and a lot of the Survivor Series matches on the show were just thrown together. It was just, what four people can we throw in? Because there was no real storylines going on between the teams, it to the point where I think Marty Jannetty was attempting to try and play face, where Leaf, his tag team partner, was trying to play heel. There was seemed to be a lot of kind of confusion there. But in terms of the wrestling, it started for me a bit. I want to say lackluster. We know that Leaf, Al Snow, and Marty Jannetty can be good wrestlers. Don't get me wrong, but they seem to not really gel well with the Godwins. We saw a little bit of back and forth with Leaf essentially spitting on, I think it was Phineas. Mm. Then it seemed to really kind of plod towards the first finish. I think Jannetty picks up an injury in the match because she seemed limping quite a lot, and he ends up being the first one to be eliminated. So I wonder if that was they called an audible because Jannetty, it really didn't look like he was limping a lot. So he is eliminated by Henry Godwin. Owen Hart quickly comes in with that spinning heel kick, which we see quite a few times over this pay-per-view. I think Savio Vega pulls it off a few times as well. He then eliminates Godwin. Then we get Phineas Godwin nailing a massive clothesline that sends Owen over the top rope. Bulldog comes in, hits the running power slam. He eliminates Phineas. Then it calms down a little bit because obviously it's now 3-on-2, and we've got Furness and LaFon, who like you said, not the crowd didn't seem to know him. They were kind of went down like a fart in church, I suppose. So take it from here, Danny. What did you think of this kind of run from Furnace and Lafont to be essentially the tag team champions and one of the new rockers?
I just wasn't impressed with these two. I'm sorry, but I had never seen this pay-per-view before. I was like, the only match I'd seen is the main event, because that was from I think a Shawn Michaels DVD about 15 years ago. But I'd never seen Doug Furness or Phil Lafon, and no, I just wasn't impressed.
Really, I mean, I thought technically they were good wrestlers. You saw some kind of like very Japanese style hard takedowns and things like that. And the drop kick that Furnace pulls off, I think that's a really nice looking drop kick. I get your point. We did, and the crowd seemed to get the same kind of mindset as you, because they weren't well known and they went over. It kind of like flattened the crowd a little bit. I suppose if you knew who they were, you could get behind them a little bit. But yeah, like I said, this was essentially to build a new challenger to Bulldog and Owen. So it would have made no sense for them to not be the survivors. It's just it seems to be something that we see going up and down this card, that the newcomers are the ones that are kind of like standing at the end of the match. But yeah, for me, it was a decent opener. I've seen better matches, but I've seen a lot worse, so I can't really kind of fault it for that. So I'll quickly run through the rest of the elimination. So we had Leaf Cassidy got eliminated by Phil Lafon. Then Bulldog was eliminated by Phil Lafon, and Owen Hart eventually gets eliminated by Doug Furness. And the two survivors are essentially the two newcomers. From a slow start to a fairly quick central part with a lot of eliminations all in quick succession. It made for a good match if you kind of like turn your brain off and didn't kind of put too much thought into it, I suppose.
Yeah, totally.
So then after this, we go into Mankind and Paul Bearer with Undertaker with Paul Bearer in the shark tank hanging above the cage. We get an interview with Mankind and Paul Bearer in essentially pitch black. Where Paul Bearer's still saying, "He's not going in the cage. No, I'm not." Funnily enough, he does end up in the cage. But Mankind, he has that interview, and then they're literally playing his music to come out to pretty much straight away. So they said that they're in the bowels of the arena. It can't be that far away from the actual arena, then. The bowels aren't that deep, are they?
Well, it was Madison Square Garden, so I don't think it was the most sanitizable place. But yeah, I did enjoy that mini interview there. I mean, you'd see this all throughout the night. They would have interviews right before the matches, which makes a big difference, rather than, because it gets you fired up a little bit. But I was wondering before we logged on here if I would get a Paul Bearer impression out of you, and I'm glad to see we got one.
I'm sure it won't be the last one of the night. What we did get, though, is when Mankind and Paul Bearer were in the ring and Paul's refusing to get into the cage, the lights go down. We get what we think is going to be the typical Undertaker entrance, and what we actually get is the first real kind of evolution of the Undertaker. Obviously, he's been in the company 6 years now, and he's technically been the actual kind of real Undertaker, where he would create the coffins and bury people and stuff like that. This is the first time he's switched away from that character and become something more kind of supernatural. Descends from the arena like Batman, you say, doing his favorite Batman impression.
Yep.
But it's he's all clad in leather, very much looking like the build up to like the ministry version of Undertaker, would you say?
Yeah, yeah, he was definitely in that phase sort of thing. He was just trying new things, I think, just trying to switch it up, as he would always do throughout his 30-year career.
Yeah, absolutely. Undertaker coming to the ring basically makes Paul Bearer think he can go to the cage for safety. And we get a cool little cage cam, which I thought was a good little spot. What do you think about this match?
I did enjoy this one a lot better than the opener because there was a lot more.
You knew who they were.
yeah, exactly. I'm a massive fan of both of these. I haven't seen too much of this version of Mankind because when I think of Mankind, I think of the white shirt and the tie and everything like that. So this Mankind, the more comedy version of him. But this I liked it a lot, and he did hit a very good-looking pile driver in this match. Did you see? Like a snap pile driver. That really impressed me. When you think pile drivers, you think Jerry Lawler, Undertaker, Kane. You don't think Mankind. But he just kind of just snapped it down. And I thought that was really good. What did you think of it so far?
Yeah, I think this is, for me, it's this was when Mankind was at his best physically, I want to say. I know he obviously had some amazing matches, but you could tell that the hardcore matches that he did really took a toll on his body. This was kind of almost like a sprightly Mankind. I mean, you've seen him do things like somersaults off the side of the ring, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. And I like the way that Undertaker not only had a change of character and a change of look, but he also added some stuff to his arsenal, his wrestling arsenal, that he didn't normally have in terms of his character work, doing a lot more kind of takedowns, a lot more brutal kind of hard hitting stuff. I think these two, whenever they wrestle together, it's pretty much always magic all the way through the crane. And we see these go against each other time and time again, and I can't think of a bad match that I've seen between these two.
No, definitely not. I mean, this may not be their most famous match, but it was really well done. I liked how Undertaker was working Mankind's hand throughout the beginning of the match because it was telling the story. It was like he's going to stop that mandible claw even if he has to break his hand. I just had a quick question about this. Who was the executioner? Because I had no idea when I was watching this.
So the executioner is a former wrestler called Terry Gordy. Essentially, he was brought in to help bury the Undertaker. Because previous to this match, Mankind and Undertaker had a buried alive match. This feud had been going on for quite a while. And the buried alive match was meant to be the blow off. So Terry Gordy was kind of one of the wrestlers that helped bury the Undertaker. He was in kind of like the decline of his career. I think just previous to this, maybe about 6 months before this, he'd actually suffered a stroke because of a heroin overdose. So this was kind of like almost like a thank you payoff from the WWE, basically give him some money, give him some work. It wasn't in the best condition at all. But it was also a way to extend this feud because obviously the payoff for this was Undertaker getting his hands on Paul Bearer, and that would have been the end of the feud. But having the executioner involved means we can extend this over the upcoming pay-per-views. They do kind of milk it. But like I said, these matches are always entertaining. And I do like the point that you made about the working on the hand. We see a kind of a twist on a famous Mankind Mick Foley move where he normally does the neck kind of gripping the ropes. I think it's called the hangman's noose or something like that. Normally he does it with the neck, but this time he does it with his hand, which I thought was a cool little touch. And then coming towards the end, he has some sort of weapon, and I couldn't actually make out what it was. First, I thought it was like a knife, and then it looked like just a piece of plastic. But he was essentially stabbing that into the head of Undertaker. The end come when he essentially jumps on the back of Undertaker. Undertaker flips him into the tombstone. I think the finish came pretty quickly out of nowhere, where Mankind looked like he was in control, especially using that weapon, and then one tombstone and the match is over. What did you think of that finish? Do you think it was rushed, or do you think it plays into the character of Undertaker?
I think it was rushed, but I'm combining that with what you said just a minute ago about it was a way to continue the story, so they didn't want to give the full gamut to everything. Like they wanted to continue this story, and you can see why they kind of just ended it early. I was a little bit disappointed with the payoff at the end when Paul Bearer came down, but. I mean, if you were there, if you paid for that, you would feel a bit upset, and he was really invested. He was like, you want to see Undertaker just get his hands on Paul Bearer, but no. But this reminds me of this stipulation, I'm sure, was done in Memphis, like in the 60s, 70s, stuff like that. It's very old school. It just seems it's like we'll put the manager up above the arena, and like it just screams Memphis to me. For some reason, what do you think?
Yeah, it's very old school booking, where you think you're gonna get the payoff, and you don't, and you end up having to buy into the next show. That and I suppose that makes sense. At the end of the day, it is a business. They're trying to get all your money out of you, I suppose. But this does lead to a match at the next pay per view. I think it's called. It's time. So that pay-per-view, we get Undertaker versus Executioner in an Armageddon rules match, apparently, which is essentially just a hardcore match. But at the finish, we get the cage is lowered. Undertaker thinks he's getting his hands on Paul Bearer. Out sprints Terry Gordy as the Executioner. That gives Paul Bearer the opportunity to leave the ring. Undertaker hits the clothesline. Executioner essentially no sells it, leaves the ring, and that's the end of the match. Undertaker, I do like this kind of change in Undertaker's character. I think he looks a lot more kind of aggressive and more fast paced. We're used to the Undertaker being a very kind of slow, methodical wrestler, but yeah, it's cool going back to see. The first kind of iteration of the Undertaker changing his character up.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. Did he take some time off before this?
So he took a little bit of time off since SummerSlam, which was the pay-per-view previous to this. Then they had a couple of pay-per-views, like B pay-per-views, like In Your Houses. But he was always kind of on the show in voiceovers, taunting Mankind and Paul Bearer. So he took a little time away, but the storyline kept chugging without him.
Yeah, yeah, perfect. Yeah.
Yep. So after that, we get Sonny coming down to the ring to do a bit of commentary. And what did you think about her and JR? Going tit for tat against each other. Jesus Christ, they were not fans of each other.
Definitely not. I felt this was one of Jim Ross's worst nights, to be honest, as a commentator, because that back and forth was like, it was just taken. It totally took away from this next match that we'll be discussing. But no, they weren't fans of each other. They were taking little barbs at each other. But I referenced it a minute ago, but. Did you see when she came out, she had to dodge the fans herself because there were a lot of fans just grabbing, just like hungrily just grabbing. It was like, what the hell's going on here? I mean, obviously they stopped that when they went back to Madison Square Garden. If you remember the WrestleMania 20 stage, how far apart the fans were on those.
Or if you remember the Royal Rumble where Cena makes his return.
Yes, totally.
There is a much wider kind of a entrance ramp. We'll get to it in the main event, but there's one fan who literally wrestles Shawn Michaels. She grips him and just won't let him go. The fans were rabid for Sable. Let's say that.
Oh, no, I was going to say, there was one little highlight there with Vince McMahon slightly trying to dance that made me laugh. If you've ever seen Vince McMahon dance, it is really funny.
And then he denied doing it to J.O., who literally caught him. We've had the misfortune of seeing this whole kind of a heel JR character from the start, and it's not good. He's not good at it. People just love JR too much, and he's just not good at pulling off the heel persona. So him being a douchebag to Sonny, and then Sonny essentially giving it him back. Yeah, you're right. It took her away from this match, but we do see a big debut in this match. So this is another Survivor Series elimination match. We've got the heels of Hunter Hearst Helmsley, Crush, Jerry Lawler, who's left commentary for this match, and Goldust, and we get like a bit of an interview with them backstage, and they're taking on Mark Miro, Rocky Maivia, Jake Roberts, and the Stalker, Barry Windham, who thankfully has lost the face paint because that was absolutely ridiculous. They make a big deal of Mark Miro being the star in this match. He even gets the opportunity to introduce Jake Roberts, who was a replacement for Mark Henry, who apparently had picked up an injury. What do you think of Mark Miro? Do you think he's going to be a star, or do you think it's what actually happens with Sable being the star and Mark being kind of her kind of like wingman, I suppose?
I'll go with the latter because did you see how many times the camera panned to Sable on the outside? You can totally understand when people talk about, like, former writers like Vince Russo or something talk about Vince McMahon's infatuation with Sable. You could just see it. This was early days, but in terms of Mark Miro, I just feel like he was just there just as a placeholder, because it didn't feel like he was a big star at all watching this. To me, it didn't feel it, because he was kind of like, it just felt like this was just a one-star match, because not in terms of like rating. I mean, one star they were focusing on, and that was Rocky Maivia. Everyone did do good in their roles and stuff. This match was just to build Rocky Maivia, in my opinion. What did you think?
Yeah, you absolutely are absolutely right. And going back to the Sable point, she was one of the biggest stars. I mean, if you go all the way back to the Hogan and Macho Man era, behind Hogan being the biggest star, the second biggest star was always Miss Elizabeth. And at this time, Sable was one of the biggest stars. Or maybe not this time, but certainly in the coming months, like the next year or so, Sable becomes one of the biggest stars in the WWE because of who she is. And I think Mark suffers from that, because it almost feels like he was brought in to bring Sable in rather than he be brought in and Sable comes along with him. And there's a lot of rumours and innuendo about Vince being so kind of infatuated with Sable being involved in wrestling that he wanted her on a totally separate contract to Mark Miro. So if they got rid of Mark Miro, she didn't essentially go with him, because he knew that there was money there with her. And before we start getting into the match as well, Sonny and Sable seem to have a very one-sided hatred. Sonny not happy at all with Sable, calls her plastic when Jim Ross says something about it, and Sable says she's 100% natural. She says that Mark Miro's got poor taste because look at the dog that he's at ringside, really kind of ripping into Sable. What did you think of this kind of like bitchiness?
This seemed like a backstage issue that was just coming on air. I mean, in storyline, was Sable and Sonny in a feud? I mean, they would be in a feud, but at this time, I don't think they were in a feud together. I mean, what was going to be the payoff? I mean, it was just Sonny was just kind of like one of the worst commentators I've heard ever. And it was like I didn't understand it, because at this point Sable was just a manager, really. She wasn't gonna get in the ring, and there was no payoff for this, so these little pot shots were kind of like unneeded.
Yeah, I agree.
Did you notice how many third and second generation stars were in this match? It was quite.
They made a huge deal of mentioning it over the match. They didn't even mention the likes of Goldust, though. They really focused on Rocky and Barry Windham. But Jake Roberts is a multi-generation wrestler. Goldust is multi-generation. It's very much a family affair in this match. Going back to the Sable point, even at this time, she wasn't even managing. She'd actually dumped all her clients. So the only time that you really saw her was when she was doing things like this, when she was doing commentary work. But the WWE were invested in her because she, at the time, was the most downloaded picture on the whole of the internet, and they make a big deal of pushing that.
Yeah, and if you don't believe her, just ask her.
Did you ever download Sonny from the internet?
I was 5 at this point, so I didn't even know what the internet was. Definitely not.
So getting into the match, and kind of like the first match, outside the Jake Roberts and Jerry Lawler stuff, which has been recurring, this is there's a little bit of the Hunter's Helms there and Mark Miro stuff, but other than that, there's not a lot of feuds in this match that they're building off. It's again just wrestlers thrown together for the sake of having a heel and a face team.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we'd see this pattern for the next 20 years, even now today, as today is Survivor Series 2021, you just see just a lot of wrestlers. But there was a few years there where they didn't have that. Like each wrestler was specifically placed into the match because they were feuding with somebody else. I think of something like 2001 when there was the Alliance and stuff like that. There was stories, but it did feel like a quite random selection of wrestlers to go in a match here.
Yeah, and I think it's either the 97 one or maybe the 98 one where we get the gang rules, where there's a lot of factions in WWF at the time, so those ones make sense. But these where the wrestlers are just thrown together, it goes back to like the late 80s, early 90s, where it was who's a heel, you're on that team, who's a face, you're on that team kind of thing. It's simple booking, I suppose. In terms of the match, again, it's nothing spectacular. For me, I think it goes a little bit too long, clocks in at almost 25 minutes. But as you said at the beginning, this was all built to build Rocker as a star. Ironically, the fans like him in this match, but they soon pretty much turn on him and telling him to die, Rocky, die. They don't kind of... they don't kind of vibe with that happy-go-lucky blue chipper, but they do make a huge deal of him being a third-generation wrestler, the very first third-generation wrestler. they make a comment about how he's named after his dad and his granddad, and how they were big stars in the garden as well. So there's a hell of a lot of love. I don't know if you watched the episode of Raw that was on previous to this, but they have a package about The Rock and him training and what he went through to become a wrestler. So that's an interesting to go back, and it's cool to see the beginning of what turns out to be the biggest star to ever come out of wrestling, I suppose.
Definitely, yeah. And I did find it weird that Jim Ross was very much behind The Rock here, despite him being a heel himself. And this was definitely a vehicle to build The Rock. And I think they did it really, really well here. Like you said, it did go on a bit long, even for me as well. But yeah, they mission accomplished on this, because The Rock did come out looking good.
Yeah, he certainly did. So the eliminations are, I think the first one is Jerry Lawler. He gets eliminated by Roberts, kind of like rubber stamping the end of their feud when Roberts hits the DDT. Then I think it's the Stalker is out next. He gets eliminated with a curtain call. They make a big issue of him, his boots that he's wearing. Sonny tries to kind of pick a fight with Jim Ross when Jim mentions the Stalker's boots. And Jim says, oh, there's a tail behind those boots. And she said, is there? Or have you just made that up? And she went, no, they're genuinely his dad's boots.
Yeah. I found that just odd. Just I think that was just Sonny just trying to pick a fight just to try to be entertaining. But yeah.
Yeah, and I think it shows that even though he's a douchebag, you miss Jerry Lawler on commentary, because he knows how to kind of play off Vince and Jim way more than Sonny does.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
So after that, we get, I think it's Triple H is eliminated next. Mark Miro does his wild thing, Miro Sol, to pin Triple H. Then Crush actually gets a couple of pins. Actually looks quite dominant. He pins Mark Miro after nailing him with that heart punch. Then he eliminates Jake Roberts. Again, I think he hits him with the heart punch. And then it essentially leaves The Rock, Rocky Maivia, 2-on-1. He's essentially getting beat down, puts up a great fight. He lands some great shots on Crush. He goes for quite a few cross body blocks. I think they're trying to push that as maybe he's going to be his finishing move. And he shows a lot of his athleticism with the kind of a leapfrog and then reverse leapfrog. But essentially, the numbers do overpower him. And then Goldust has his arms behind his back. Crush goes for the knockout punch. Rocky ducks. He hits Goldust. So Rocky is able to get the pin on Goldust. Then hit he gets the pin on Crush first, and then he is able to hit the crossbody on Goldust and pick up. Oh no, he gets the shoulder breaker on Goldust, I think, to pick up the victory. Like I said, average match, but the whole point of this was to show you that this new blue chipper was the future of the company. Do you think, looking at this performance, that he was going to turn out, if you'd have watched this and never known how he went on, do you think he would have been the biggest star that potentially came out of the company and essentially the biggest star in Hollywood today? Would you have got that vibe from this young Rocky Maivia?
Yes, on this night, yes, but I'm not sure how it goes forward after this, but I would have definitely seen big things for him, but I don't think that big, but we would have seen, I've already seen a main eventer in a year or so, but I think it took them about 2 years to make him a main eventer. But yeah, you could definitely see The Rocket was on him, The Rocket.
Yeah, and you can certainly see, for me at least, that charisma of The Rock. Even though he's still fresh and he's still green, you can see the shades of the person he would turn into be. And it's always kind of said in wrestling that the best characters are always when you're playing yourself, but you just turn the dial up to 11. And you can see how that really worked for Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
Definitely.
So then after this, we go into essentially what many people call the main event. It's certainly the most pushed match of this card. Stone Cold Steve Austin taking on Bret the Hitman Hart. This is the first match back for Bret since he lost the title at WrestleMania. And since then, Austin's gone on to win King of the Ring. Now, going back before watching the shows back, you would kind of think that the King of the Ring meant that Austin was an instant big star. The way that the narrative goes for WWF, that he wins King of the Ring, does his Austin 316 promo, and then the day after, he's this massive star pushed straight into the main event picture. But we're actually now nearly 6 months away from him winning that King of the Ring, and it's actually been a really slow build to get him to this point. And even now he's not up there with the title contenders. But what Bret does in this match and the feud that goes on after this match is he essentially he makes Stone Cold Steve Austin a made man. Him coming back it solidifies Stone Cold Steve Austin. He says that Stone Cold is the best wrestler in the company. He wants to come back and face him. And then you've got the heel Stone Cold who's absolutely shitting on Bret Hart, saying, you're a coward. You couldn't beat Shawn Michaels. If you put the S in front of Hitman, that's what I think of him. And we're coming off the whole kind of Pillman's Got a Gun palaver that happened as well. Austin getting pissed off that Bret is getting interviews at home, whereas he has to come to the studio for tapings. So there's a lot of kind of that professional rivalry there. And also they're playing two totally different characters. Austin's being like the douchebag heel and Bret is still the kind of superhero face, I suppose, of wrestling. This match has been absolutely built up to the hills over the past rows, to the point where we've said on A Change in Attitude that it's kind of, the booking has kind of overshadowed the main event. This for me feels bigger than the title match, and this is the first match of their kind of a sequence of matches that, and it is probably the worst match as well. Being fair, but this match is so damn good. Such a great match for me. I think it's easily the best match on the card. I don't know about yourself. Let us know what you thought of this match.
I would agree with that. Being the best match of the night, because I thought that for years. Like after Stone Cold won the King of the Ring, he was a made man, and he was in main events and everything like that. It's only from listening to this show that I've learned. Oh no, wait! Like no, it wasn't all sunshine and roses. But this in terms of this match, yeah, there was a. To me, I actually enjoyed this match more than the WrestleMania 13, and I know that's unpopular opinion, but I think this match told and I know that's a popular opinion, but I actually enjoyed how they took their time with this, as they did with the other match as well, but they took their time, and this match, it really stood out. One horrendous bump that we're going to talk about as we get further into this match.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey folks, PC Tony here. Thanks to our new partnership with Angry Lemonade, you can save 10% on physical products and digital commissions using the promo code CHAIRSHOT. Head to angrylemonade.net to check out their amazing catalog of products and services. Use the promo code CHAIRSHOT to save 10%. That's angrylemonade.net.
Are you looking for the newest and hottest in the world of pro wrestling?
Then check out the amazing action on Powerslam.tv, the biggest indie pro wrestling channel in the world. Get over 6,000 hours of the best events from over 150 of your favorite promotions from 20 different countries around the globe. Brands like Progress Wrestling, Evolve Wrestling, Combat Zone, Defy, PCW Ultra, PWX, Over the Top, Shine, and hundreds of others with fresh content added every day for only $5.99 per month. Get your free trial today at powerslam.tv.
Go to powerslam.tv, promo code CHAIRSHOT, get your free month. Again, that's powerslam.tv, promo code CHAIRSHOT.
TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, I mean, I can see your point. I think the good thing with Bret Hart, and we've covered it a lot over on That 90s Wrestling Podcast with Dan and Rob and James, just how amazing a wrestler that Bret Hart is, that he can wrestle the same person multiple times and each match be totally different. Even when he had the King of the Ring, he had three different opponents wrestle three totally different matches with three totally different finishes. So putting Austin in the ring against someone as good as Bret Hart, it was always going to be a good match, because Bret can... I know it's a cliche, but he could wrestle a broom to a four-star match. When you put in a wrestler like Austin, who I think his technical wrestling skill is pretty underrated. Before he got his severe knee and neck injuries, he was actually a really good technical wrestler. It's only after the injuries he transitioned into more of a brawling style, because it was easier on his joints. But this match was, I thought it was technically superb from both people. The leg drops, the stun gun on the ropes. But the good thing is it Bret Hart and Austin are always able to take you on a journey, almost a story. So you start with technical wrestling, then you build into brawling, then it kind of keeps ramping up and ramping up to the where it's essentially becoming more hardcore, and it's becoming really, really brutal. We see Hart get slingshotted into the Spanish announce table, and Jim Ross makes a funny quip about how it always seems to happen to the Spanish guys. So what did you think of the kind of like the build in this story? Because we're looking at like almost a 30-minute match here. And it can be really hard to kind of like keep the crowd and the fans interested for such a long match. What did you think of the way that the two controlled the ring?
I really enjoyed it. This was Bret Hart's first match back as well after a long break. And I think anyone who can take that long length of time off and come back and deliver a match like this is just something of a magician, because, like you said, it was just the way that they controlled the ring. It was like it just kept the fans invested. That slingshot was the awful bump I was talking about, because every match, every hardcore match where they go through the Spanish announce tables, that the wrestlers are always taking the monitors out of the off the table, making it as safe as they can before they put their opponent through it. But this time Stone Cold didn't care, he just slingshotted him and he even ended up on Carlos Cabrera's lap as well, and it just looked more unplanned, and I liked that part of it as well. Yeah, really good match overall.
Yeah, and I thought as well the finish was really well done, really kind of interesting. So we see Bret Hart essentially stuck in a Texas cloverleaf, kind of like playing off the fact he does the sharpshooter. And then we see Austin hit a stunner. Then we see him actually go for the sharpshooter. We see the $1 million dream applied, Hart struggling to get out of it. And the really clever kind of escape was when he climbs up the turnbuckles, kind of pushes off the top turnbuckle, forces Austin onto his back, and then kind of rolls over. So he's getting the pin, even though he's still trapped in the submission move. A really, really clever finish. Hart picks up the win on his first match back, but I don't think Austin comes out of this looking any worse off, because he's gone 30 minutes with arguably one of the best wrestlers in the world at this time, and he hasn't looked out of place.
Yeah, totally, totally agreed. I mean, he definitely hung in there with Bret Hart, and yeah.
And then we find out, Vince kind of stumbles over his words a little bit, but Jim Ross saves him. But we find out that this win means that Bret Hart essentially gets the title match at the next pay-per-view, which I think is actually called It's Time, because it was meant to be Vader getting that pay-per-view spot, but after what happened at SummerSlam and Shawn Michaels essentially politicking his way to not losing to Vader because he felt that he worked unsafe, it means that Bret Hart is in that title picture instead.
Yeah, definitely.
So then we get an interview from Psycho Sid, very quiet, a quick interview, but he mentions the word tonight about 45 times in it. Then we get another throwaway Survivor Series match. This time, this was meant to have a special guest. So we had Farouk coming out to some pre-Eminem white rapping. This is a total change of character for Farouk. He obviously is coming to the WWF as this Spartan gladiator wearing a tinfoil helmet. Went away for a little while after the Ahmed Johnson feud, and now he's come back as the leader of what we'll eventually see being the faction, the Nation of Domination. And he's teaming with fake Razor Ramon, even faker Diesel and Big Van Vader, and they're going up against the team of Savio Vega, Yokozuna returning, Flash Funk, also known as Too Cold Scorpio, and the special star. And I don't know how Jim Ross and Vince were so surprised, because they literally put him in the Hall of Fame the night before, Superfly Jimmy Snuka. Yep. What do you think of Jimmy Snuka as a mystery opponent?
I was actually a big fan of Jimmy Snuka until I watched Dark Side of the Ring and found that horrific murder he committed. But did you notice what was it, the underwhelming pop that he got from this crowd? It was very lukewarm. I think this was an underwhelming surprise, to be honest. What did you think?
Yeah, I think this was a Snuka who was well past his prime. I mean, he had a monumental feud with Roddy Piper that culminated in matches at Madison Square Garden. So he was famous in this arena, but you are right, the crowd, I think it was almost, they knew that it was going to be Snuka, so there was no kind of big surprise there, which kind of ended up being a bit of a damp squib. Plus, when you're facing fake Diesel and fake Razor, nobody cares. Everybody hated this gimmick, so putting Superfly on the opposite team, it was kind of like papering over the cracks, I suppose.
That's what I was going to say about fake Razor and Diesel, is I was under the impression fake Razor and Diesel only lasted a couple of weeks, but here we are, months after.
It does die a death pretty soon, which is a saving grace, I suppose. And it's a shame, really, because this, if he wasn't the fake Razor character, I don't think that Rick Bognar was a bad wrestler. I mean, he does a fall-away slam on Savio Vega in this match, and it's actually really tidy the way he does it. And the same can go be said for Diesel. He ends up being Kane, who's one of the best gimmick characters, what certainly one of the best big man wrestlers that the company's ever seen. So these aren't poor wrestlers. These are just good wrestlers in a very shit gimmick.
Definitely. And did you notice Jim Ross's line about dig at Hulk Hogan during Flash Funk's entrance?
I've never seen somebody look so good in red and yellow in this arena. He also has a dig at Scott Hall as well. He says, I don't know why everyone's giving Razor Ramon a load of grief. Look at the kid. He's an absolute blue chipper. Certainly not as ugly as the first person who had that. Jesus Christ, Chip. Jesus Christ.
He was really healing it up here, wasn't he?
Yeah, he certainly was. This match is absolutely nothing to write home about. Less than 10 minutes long. We only actually see a couple of eliminations. I think Savio Vega is eliminated by Diesel after the jackknife. And then we see Razor Ramon get eliminated after the Superfly. But essentially, it all descends into madness when Diesel hits Snuka with a chair. Savio Vega, I don't know whether he was watching backstage on the monitor, but as soon as he sees that, he starts sprinting down to the ringside with a chair. All eight guys end up having a brawl, and eventually Matt Chioda waves the match off. No survivors. Ends in double disqualification. What did you think about this finish?
Oh, very lame, very lame. But it was welcomed at this point because this match felt like such a mess, and it just felt like something that would belong on a pre-show. That after it just kind of phased away to the next segment, I was thinking, well, I'm not too angry about that, but at least we didn't have to sit through five eliminations or however many, maybe nine. They would have, if Vince McMahon got his way, he would have booked it like this. But I'm sure this was cut from timing issues because you still had the main event to come.
I think this the placing of this match was to kind of be a palate cleanser from the Bret Hart and Stone Cold match. I think if you'd have gone from that match straight into the Shawn Michaels and Sid match, maybe the crowd wouldn't have been as hyped up. So you needed kind of like essentially that piss break match. And that's what this was, which is sad for the people in the match, but it is what it is. This was never with the stars in this match. This was never going to be a technical masterpiece, especially on the heel side. It was very kind of like bruiser style wrestling.
Definitely. I mean, I know that sometimes they do cut matches just before they go out and you just see the reactions of the wrestlers. But, I mean, this one was welcomed in this household.
So after that, we're getting into the main event. We get a video package showing the kind of the trials and tribulations between Shawn Michaels and Psycho Sid, how they were enemies and then friends and then back to enemies and covering all the kind of mistakes. Sid came out, and again, you made the point a couple of times over this show, the crowd were essentially scratching and clawing to get to Sid. He was huge at this point. The fans were absolutely in love with him. He comes to the ring, essentially fist bumping everyone who puts out their hand. Then we see the fireworks, and I think that's always a really cool look with the big Sid fireworks. It shows that the company was very much behind him.
Yeah, definitely.
And then we see Shawn Michaels coming out with Jose Lothario. And this is where, for me, the crowd went overboard. There's a woman who grabs Shawn Michaels by the arm, and you can see that he's really kind of struggling to get away from her. I think security even had to come in and break it up. But professionally, Shawn took it on the chin. Even I think there's a member of the crowd who he gives a kiss to on the way to the ring. But yeah, he is. Whether he's the heel in this match, I mean, you can't really tell because they both seem to be getting so many cheers. But he was a star for all his politicking, for all the douchebaggery he pulled off. He looked every single inch the WWF champion.
Definitely. I mean, this was one of his finest moments. Until the finish itself, but the amount of cheers he got, it was confusing to watch this because he was thinking, who is the heel and who's the babyface? Because Sid was fist bumping like a face, and Shawn Michaels was kind of like is working as a heel in some of this matches. This was actually pretty good.
Yeah, and it starts off in a typical Sid match where he's using his power to basically beat down on Michaels, and a lot of what looked like stiff shots from Sid. Jim Ross makes a comment on saying that Shawn Michaels needs to not be standing still. He needs to be using his momentum and getting Sid off his feet. Eventually, we see that, and there's a kind of like a back and forth in people being in control. I did like there's a little segment where Shawn Michaels uses a headlock takedown to control Sid. Then he does when Sid's trying to get his way out, he does a kip up. And then Sid does a headlock takedown to Shawn Michaels when Shawn kind of works his way out of that. Sid does a kip up as well. I mean, for somebody the size of Sid to be able to pull that off, I thought that was a cool little spot.
That was really good. Yeah, it was really impressive because I don't think I've ever seen Sid do that since or before this. So.
Yeah, I mean, he's not known for doing flamboyant moves like that. I mean, there's a famous one where he tries to do a kick off the top rope and absolutely just snaps his leg in half. So, yeah, it's not often you see Sid able to kind of like leave his feet with the grace that he does. We see Sid shoving a cameraman, which comes in is important later on. But yeah, the back and forth in this match to say that Sid wasn't the best technical wrestler. I mean, JR absolutely buries him by saying he's a terrible technical wrestler, which I thought was a bit on the nose by JR. I think Michaels and him have great chemistry, and they really kind of work well as a pair to give us a really, really good match. What did you think of this match?
Before I get into the match, I just want to say a line from Jim Ross that was said when they was outside of the ring. Jim Ross made the bold statement here of the fans aren't going to pay your next grocery bill. Right? Have you heard the story of that fan who died and left $2.5 million to Shawn Michaels? In his inheritance, but this happened before, this happened about 3 years before. It was around that time that Shawn Michaels had quit the WWF, and but yeah, that just made me laugh because it was like that is literally when in referencing Shawn Michaels. I'm not sure if that was a dig or not, but that made me laugh. In terms of the match, it was like this was like a Sid dominating a lot of it. You're right, Jim Ross did go out of his way to take some shots at Sid Vicious, including when he was making his entrance. Jim Ross said Shawn Michaels has made a lot of more money being bigger guys than Sid Vicious, which was kind of just burying Sid Vicious there. But the crowd loved Sid all throughout this match. So anytime he was on the offense, he was getting cheered. And anytime Shawn Michaels was on the offense, he was getting booed. And you could see Shawn Michaels was getting frustrated throughout some of it as well.
Yeah, but you do get the kind of like the greatest hits almost. We see Shawn Michaels skinning the cat. What I do like though is that every time that Shawn Michaels did one of his classic moves, Sid just leveled him with a clothesline. There's another point where he does another kip up after a flying forearm, and Sid just levels him with a clothesline again the minute he gets back on his feet. The finish comes when Sid essentially grabs the camera, hits Jose Lothario with it. It absolutely looks ridiculous, but Jose is there on the floor, looking like he's having some sort of like heart problem, which kind of distracts Shawn Michaels from the match. He hits the sweet chin music, but instead of going for the pin, he goes to check on Jose Lothario, screaming at the backstage staff to send somebody down to help. Sid comes out, gets Michaels back in the ring. We see a little bit of a behind the curtain where Sid and Michaels are talking their way through what's going to happen next, which leads to the crossbody shot on Earl Hebner when Sid ducks. Michaels again doesn't kind of capitalize. He goes on to check on Jose Lothario again. And yet again, nobody's come down. I mean, if he was having a real heart attack, you'd be disgusted in the fact they've not sent any medical staff down. But this is where Sid comes out with the camera, hits Michaels in the back of the head with it. There's a lot of play about Jose having this heart attack, and Jim Ross, who was sat maybe six to 10 yards away, didn't go and help, but just said, "I just hope he's not having a heart attack." We then see essentially Sid roll Michaels back into the ring, hit the powerbomb. Earl Hebner counts the pin, and we have a new champion. But Shawn Michaels being Shawn Michaels, he kind of in that Hulk Hogan vein, couldn't let Sid just have the moment to kind of get all the applause. He has to be that the center of attention, throwing the medical staff and the officials out of the way to help Jose Lothario get back to backstage. He does the crawling thing as well, which I thought was ridiculous to look at, but actually made sense if you want to avoid those grabbing fans, being able to kind of like crawl past them rather than be manhandled by him. But yeah, I felt a bit bad for Sid that Shawn Michaels was still the star of this. But I thought it was a great match, probably one of the best that I remember of Sid's career. And it just goes to show, as much of a douchebag he was, Shawn Michaels could get the best out of any opponent that he faces.
Definitely. I mean, I remember reading quite a while ago that this was actually supposed to be Vader versus Shawn Michaels. But, I mean, obviously, politicking and the SummerSlam 96 match saw to it that it wasn't to be. But I just kept thinking, imagine if that was Vader actually winning the title that night. That would have been pretty cool as well. But I was happy for Sid as well. But as you said, Shawn Michaels was the more fans cared about what happened to Jose than Sid Vicious. But they did explode when he won the belt, and I really enjoyed that.
Yeah. So that's the end of the show. The lights go down with Sid as champion. What did you think of the show overall?
Overall, this pay-per-view had three highlights to me that were memorable, because you've seen them years and years for our video packages. Was The Rock's debut, Sid Vicious winning, and Hart versus Austin. Other than that, there were some good points as well, but those were the three that really stood out. What did you think?
Yeah, absolutely. You've hit the nail on the head. This is a forgettable Big Four pay-per-view, apart from the fact that we get the kind of start of the Austin and Bret Hart feud. Shawn Michaels makes Psycho Sid look like absolutely $1 million, and we get that debut of The Rock. So for those three moments alone, they're definitely things that you want to go back and check out. The rest of the card is very ho-hum, typical of a Survivor Series. Nothing really kind of stands out after the event. But yeah, thanks for coming on, Danny. Thanks for reviewing Survivor Series with us, and we'll be having you on over a few times over the next few weeks to kind of fill in for Tanner whilst he's in the process of moving and sorting his new job out. Thanks for filling in. Let everybody know where they can get hold of you on social media, sir.
Yep. So thank you for having me on. I really enjoyed today. So on social media, I'm just at Scottish Juggalo on Twitter. I know I don't sound Scottish, but believe me, I am. And that's about it, really. I just do little videos where I just tag everyone in and at cool moments of wrestling. And other than these podcasts, I'm really not on anything else, but I'll chat with anyone on there. So thank you.
Yeah, definitely go give Danny a follow. That's at Scottish Juggalo. We have so many fun conversations about the videos he puts up, and yeah, he's been doing the rounds on podcasts. So hopefully you'll hear more from him, because he's, like I said, he's one of the brighter sparks now in the wrestling community. He really kind of gets a lot of conversation flowing and really positive. So yeah, I'm glad we were able to do this, and I'm glad you'll be able to come on a few more times over the next coming weeks. But yeah, essentially that's all for this week's episode of A Changing Attitude. Next week we'll be covering the Raw after this pay-per-view. So that's the 18th of November 1996. But before that, go and give me a follow on Twitter at PodfatherMags. Follow my absent co-host at Ori the Draw and at Texas Gentleman. And definitely go and follow the network at Chairshot Media. And go and check out all the amazing content on here. Far better content than I produce. Guys like Bandwagon Nerds, DWR, so much amazing content. Outsiders Edge. Very, very privileged to be part of this team. And whilst you're there, definitely go and check out the Pro Wrestling Tees site for Chairshot. Get some amazing content and amazing merchandise, especially coming up to Christmas. Get your loved one a hashtag journalism or Chairshot 316 shirt. But yeah, that's all from us here. And remember that you must always use your head.
Chairshot.com. Always use your head.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.